And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
This is the KBOO Evening News headlines. Coming up on KBOO Evening News, natural gas pipelines and terminal at Jordan Cove along the Oregon coast. Portlander sues city over police using excessive force during the August 4th protests downtown. And in international news, India facing highest unemployment rates in 45 years. Good evening. This is the KBOO News for Friday, February 1st, 2019. I'm Tammy Hoptias.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Here is your evening report. According to a press release from her office, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has directed Portland Fire and Rescue to indefinitely pause any unreinforced masonry or URM building enforcement. The URM ordinance was approved by City Council a few months before Hardesty took office and would require all unreinforced masonry building to display a large placard with large red U for unsafe during an earthquake. Commissioner Hardesty's press release explains that she needs to spend more time speaking with the community members about the issue. The ordinance would disproportionately harm other than white people and the Portland chapter of the NCCAP that opposes it. In a letter to Portland City Council, they compare it to other harms that have been committed against the African American community, including exclusionary laws, redlining, and the use of eminent domain. While Commissioner Hardesty may not have the votes in council to overturn the ordinance, her jurisdiction over Portland Fire and Rescue makes non-cooperation a tool in her work towards a less racist Portland.
Earlier today, the City of Portland released an independent study of police officer shootings. The outside analysis of Portland police practice is mandated by the U.S. Department of Justice in response to Portland's history of abusive policing. The report raises new questions about the 2017 police killing in Portland teenager Quanice Hayes, according to the Portland Police Bureau, the officer simply feared for his life and was simply justified the killing. According to the independent report, however, the officer who intercepted Hayes should have better coordinated the orders. They were yelling, "Better protect themselves from anticipated gunfire," and slowed down their entire response to better calculate their actions. In not unrelated news, the Portland City Council will reconsider the firing of an officer who made racist remark related to Hayes' death.
Yesterday, Tracy Molina filed a tort claim notice with the City of Portland, declaring her intent to sue for excessive use of force and violations of her First Amendment rights. The filing is the third such tort claim stemming from the August 4, 2018 protests in downtown Portland. On that date, a right-wing group held a rally on the South Waterfront, and Molina was part of a large counter-demonstration staged right across the street. Online video of the event shows Molina complying with police orders and walking away from the protest when she was pushed from behind by a uniformed officer. Tracy Molina claims that the police action had no legal basis and that the police were acting with prejudice to punish one side of the protest.
There are just 2 days left in the public comment period on a proposed natural gas pipeline and terminal at Jordan Cove along the Oregon coast. A Canadian fossil fuel corporation has made plans to build the Jordan Cove Energy Project in order to export fracked liquefied natural gases from Canada and the Rockies throughout southern Oregon. Many people are concerned drinking water of 150,000 Oregonians could be at risk. For more information, please go to lngexports.org. Comments are due by this Sunday.
The Department of Justice has formally announced its green light for a merger of two of the world's largest drug companies, Bayer and Monsanto. This decision comes despite the 1 million public comments received by the Department of Justice that oppose the merger. More than 93% of farmers and 90% of Americans as a whole are opposed to or concerned about this merger. That's according to recent polls. Friends of the Earth called the approval of the Bayer-Monsanto merger a disaster for American farmers and families. The group says that this toxic mega-merger will only further entrench the failing model of chemical-intensive agriculture, which is poisoning people and the planet. The merger is not yet finalized, but the DOJ approval puts the two companies one step closer to creating what would likely be the world's largest pharmaceutical mega-corporation.
Facebook's latest privacy scandal led an unexpected blowback from Apple this week. After Facebook was exposed contributing an app that allowed them to spy on users' activities, Facebook employees arrived to work on Wednesday to find out that all the company's internal apps have stopped working. Their work calendars, campus apps, maps, schedules, and menus were all shut down by Apple. When Apple discovered that Facebook had violated rules by spying on users, it revoked Facebook's special access to apps and updates that run on its iPhone software.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana lawmakers are considering a bill to honor Native Americans by establishing Indigenous Peoples Day with the state holiday. The bill seeks to remove Columbus Day and add Indigenous Peoples Day in November, the day before Thanksgiving. Representative Shane Morgeau testified about his bill Thursday in a House committee, saying it's hurtful to celebrate Columbus due to the atrocities committed against Native people. He says instead the state should recognize the cultural heritage of Indigenous people. The Native American caucus spoke in support of the bill, as well as members from the Native American community. Opponents who spoke asked to share the holiday, including a representative from the Montana Knights of Columbus, who called for forgiveness on all sides. Another concern raised during the hearing was more time off in the state by adding another holiday. State lawmakers in Nebraska are considering legislation to address missing and murdered Indigenous women. The bill, recently introduced by Senator Tom Brewer, calls for a study and data collection by the state patrol. It would require the state patrol to work with tribal, local, and federal agencies to identify barriers, examine ways to provide state resources to address the issue, and recommendations to improve the reporting of missing Native American women in Nebraska. Other states are considering similar legislation, including in Washington. A bill was introduced last week to build upon 2018 legislation on missing and murdered Native women. A Native women's advocacy group says they have not seen any of the royalty money they were promised by the director of the 2017 film Wind River. The Weinstein Company distributed the film, but since then the company was bought. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
The film Wind River was about the rape and murder of a northern Arapaho woman, and it came out just before Harvey Weinstein, the film's distributing company owner, was accused of sexual assault by numerous women. That's when the film's director, Taylor Sheridan, announced that he would donate distribution royalties to the nonprofit National Indigenous Women's Resource Center in Montana. The Weinstein Company was bought out by Lantern Entertainment, and the advocacy group says it's unclear whether that company will honor the promise to donate all royalties from the film. The National Indigenous Women's Resource Center is among many entities that are caught up in the financial woes that Lantern inherited, and it's questionable whether they'll ever see any of what they were promised. The Weinstein Company declared bankruptcy, clearing them of any obligation to stand by the promise. The advocacy group says they continue to remain in good communication with Director Taylor Sheridan and his staff. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards.
Tribal lands went through some of the coldest weather this week with a polar vortex. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports, conditions will briefly change.
Hundreds of record lows were recorded in the area of the polar vortex this week. Sisseton, South Dakota, on land belonging to the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, had a wind chill reading of 71 degrees below zero Tuesday night. National Weather Service meteorologist Janice Maldonado says some people in the Midwest will see a large temperature rebound this weekend. Maldonado says the warmth will extend through Saturday and into a good part of Sunday.
We are expecting a wintry mix of precipitation as the next system is expecting to move through the area. And after that system, behind that system, we are expecting another round of very cold temperature, going back again into the single digits.
Maldonado says the colder period should extend through most of next week, with the most bitterly cold weather predicted for Wednesday and Thursday. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellen Bolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Time was 1960, the place, the USA. February 1st became a history-making day. Greensboro across the land, the news spread far and wide. Silently and bravely, youth took the giant stride. Heed the call, Americans all.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 5:20, it's In the City with KBOO's Oliver Minslow. At 5:40, it's a community report with KBOO's Findy Germany. At 6 o'clock, it's Evergreen for Bread and Roses with Rachel Hartley. At 7 o'clock, it's The Struggle with Elisa Pariah. Tonight's weather is going to be around high 50s. Winds going south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chances of rain at 80%. Tomorrow's weather is going to be cloudy with a high of 51 degrees. Winds blowing north of 5 to 10 miles per hour. The evening will have a low of 35 degrees with northwest winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today in history, 1960, four black students at North Carolina Agriculture and Technical College, Azale Blair Jr., David Richmond, Franklin McLean, and Joseph McNeil staged the first sit-in at Wellworth's segregated lunch counter in downtown Greensboro, North Carolina. The four men refused to give up their seats, which triggered sit-ins nationwide for years to come. Also today, 1965, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and 770 others were arrested in protest against voter discrimination in Alabama. Our quote of the day is going to be from Ida B. Wells. The people must know before they can act, and there is no educator to compete with the press.
No mobs of violence and of hate shall turn me from my goal. No Jim Crow law.
And the news continues with word of a new bill to preserve a free and open internet that's on its way to the Senate after the FCC gutted net neutrality in 2017. Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts said today he would soon introduce a bill to permanently reinstate the net neutrality rules that were repealed by the FCC 2 years ago. Markey's announcement comes as a federal court today heard arguments over the FCC's repeal of net neutrality regulations. Net neutrality ensures internet users have equal and open access to all websites and services. Without it, the internet will soon become a pay-to-play type of platform in which smaller independent websites and services would become more difficult to access. When a government agency changes a major rule like net neutrality, it's required to show that they have a good reason and consult with the public. However, they can't just change the rules to help big campaign donors or their former employees. In the case of net neutrality, that is exactly what happened. Ajit Pai ignored overwhelming expert testimony, mountains of evidence, small business owners, veterans, and millions of public comments in favor of net neutrality, and pushed through the repeal anyway.
Did you read Catcher in the Rye in high school? Many of us did, and the book's author, D.J. Salinger, was a well-known recluse who wrote prolifically for 50 years, but rarely published before his death in 2010. No exact date for publication has been announced, but Matt Salinger, the author's son, told The Guardian that since 2011, he and the author's widow have been working, quote, as fast as they freaking can, end quote, to ready the writings for publication.
In an Oval Office interview this morning, Donald Trump railed against the Russian investigation, what else is new, and continued to threaten to declare a national emergency in order to build his border wall. In the same interview, Trump whined about being treated unfairly by the press, saying that he is, quote, entitled to a good story in the New York Times.
And in international news, Prime Minister Modi of India has been accused, alongside his government, of suppressing unemployment statistics. The statistics, which leaked last week, revealed 2007 had the highest rate of unemployment rate in India in the last 45 years. Prime Minister Modi ran on a platform built on Hindu nationalism and the promise of job creation, the latter of which the report appears to indicate has failed. Modi's government has scrambled to remedy backlash from the unemployment numbers. As recently as 2016, over 150 million public servant employees participated in a general strike and grounded the country to a halt.
And now it's time for your Middle East Minute. A new U.S. law leads to Palestinian Authority to cut U.S. aid.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Salim Shahadeh. The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has ceased all assistance to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza today at the request of the Palestinian Authority. The decision was linked to a January 31st deadline set by new U.S. legislation, under which foreign aid recipients would be more exposed to anti-terrorism lawsuits, as the Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act empowers Americans to sue foreign aid recipients in U.S. courts over alleged complicity in acts of war. Secretary General of the PLO, Saab Erekat, said at a press conference in Ramallah, Palestine, that, quote, "We do not want to receive any money if it will cause us to appear before courts," close quote. USAID is the main agency administering U.S. foreign assistance in the Palestinian territories. According to its website, the agency spent $268 million on public projects in the West Bank and Gaza, as well as Palestinian private sector debt repayment in 2017. But there were significant cuts to all new funding through the end of June 2018. It is unclear how long the cessation will last. The official said no steps were currently being taken to close the USAID office in the Palestinian territories, and no decision had been made about future staffing at the USAID mission in the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. A spokesperson for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said, "The suspension of aid to our people, which included critical sectors such as health and education, will have a negative impact on all and create a negative atmosphere," close quote. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 1st, 2019. Here are the talking points again. Natural gas pipeline terminal at Jordan Cove along the Oregon coast. Another Portlander sues the city over police using excessive force during the August 4th protests downtown. And in international news, India's facing highest unemployment rates in 45 years. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Mayer, Oliver Mintz-Lowe, Findy Germany, myself, Tammy Hopteus, and Michelle Kapala. Our producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our director of Evening News and Public Affairs, Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
And coming up tomorrow on KBOO in the morning at 7, it is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, host Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey take your calls. At 9, it's Prescription for Justice. Today, host Dr. Martin Donahoe speaks with Chuck Johnson of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about recent victories in the movement to abolish nuclear weapons. At 10 a.m. on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein's guest is Professor Paul Thiers. He'll be talking about the methanol plant in Kalama, Washington, proposed for construction by the Chinese government. And at 11, Ellen Goldsmith hosts Health Watch. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio with Will Hall. The topic is recovery from schizophrenia.
That was the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next is In the City with Oliver Minslow.
The 2018 gubernatorial election was the most expensive race in Oregon history. Both candidates raised significant sums of money, much of which was from large donors, most notably the $2.5 million donated to Republican candidate Newt Bueller by Nike co-founder Phil Knight. But while over $35 million poured into the governor's race, Portland voters resoundingly approved ballot measure 26-200 with 87% of the vote to limit campaign contributions in city elections to $500. Governor Brown has also spoken in support of campaign finance reform, both during the campaign and since her re-election, addressing the newly formed Senate Committee on Campaign Finance to affirm her support. This week, a group of legislators, activists, and supporters of Measure 26-200 addressed a packed room to discuss the next steps. Newly elected City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty talked about the need for the council to fully implement the measure and the desire for people-powered campaigns.
The good news is there are three strong women that are going to absolutely make sure that the public finance system is implemented as we envision. And we're going to make sure that the little barriers, like nobody wanted it in their bureau, right? Like the auditor doesn't want it, finance director doesn't want it. And I didn't realize that employees got to tell you what they would and wouldn't do, right? So I'm having some of those conversations internally, so it's going to be a little interesting, right? But the bottom line is that this is a people's voice, right? And I can tell you from personal experience, when I started the journey of running for public office, I knew from day one that I would never have the money that the big money candidates would have. But I was absolutely confident that I had the people who would be willing to, for a year solid, knock on doors, talk to people, ask them about their dreams, their aspirations, what they wanted their city to be. I knew that nobody could match me with people who would be willing to put in the people power to make sure that a real person, someone who had to work for a living, someone who's working class, someone who values unions and organizing and making sure that working people are treated fairly, would be in the city. And so I can tell you, even now, City Club just did a report on redistricting. And I can tell you, 99% of the times, people who are in elected office want no part of election reform, right? They say, it works fine. I got here, what's the problem, right? Why are you trying to fix it now, right? And it takes the power of regular people to be able to tell the story. I can tell the story that when people say, who elected you? I say the people of Portland. 2,900 donors, over 50,000 doors knocked. I can't tell you how many phone calls, but Matt could tell you that off the top of his head because he was the one organizing that. Collie Edwards, my chief of staff, is back there. She's short, but if she waves her hand, you'll know she's there. So I can tell you from personal experience, it matters. So when I would stand up in front of people and say, people that look like you are the ones that are financing my campaign, right? The big folks aren't offering me big checks. But here's what's ironic. So now I'm an elected leader, right? You can't buy me a $2 cup of coffee because that might influence my vote, right? But people can give you $20,000 and $30,000 for your campaign,
yeah.
And we're supposed to believe that that has no impact on how you're going to vote, right? But heaven forbid you buy me a cup of coffee, because that's just going to put me over the top, right? This is why we need campaign finance reform, and we need it at every level, right? And so I can commit to you that the city of Portland, in fact, on Wednesday, we're going to vote in our oversight committee. They're going to start working so that in 2020, the first election where the public finance system at the city of Portland will be ready for the public to actually utilize it. We are thrilled with this, right? This is would not have happened without community advocacy.
Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Mearon is a supporter of the City of Portland measure and the similar measure which passed in Multnomah County in 2016. She explained how the pressure of raising large sums of money can place a burden on candidates running for election and takes time away from discussing the issues and talking to voters.
One of the key things that I knew from the get-go was that I was going to have to raise a lot of money. I was told, okay, you don't get to go out there and talk about the issues that are important to you. You don't get to talk to voters. You don't get to talk to people in the community. You need to get on the phone and start calling everyone you know and asking them for money. The more people you know who have more money, the better things will be for you. And this is because there are a lot of sophisticated campaign election strategies, messaging strategies to reach out to voters that are increasingly expensive. So in Oregon, because we are the second worst in the country in terms of our campaign finance laws, we see this play out. We've seen this play out in record amounts of contributions being made in our governor's race. So we see it at the top, and we see it at even the local level and in our school board races, where there are record numbers, there's record numbers of money involved in these races. And this is to, like, run for a position where, a volunteer position where you're not even getting paid and you're raising $300,000 to run for this position. It's out of control. And the impact that has on, you know, when you're running for office, it's sort of like you're dividing yourself in two. You're two different people. You're the candidate. You're the person that you hope you will be when you are elected to office. And then you're sort of this wheeler-dealer person who is calling the people that you know and trying to raise the money. And you can't even go out and talk to voters if you're even in a district where that's possible, to, like, knock on doors and things, until you've kind of hit that rep where you can afford the mailers, afford the calls, afford all of these other things in your campaign.
Oregon is one of 11 states with no limits on campaign contributions. A 2015 report by the Center for Public Integrity gave Oregon a grade F in a state integrity report relating to accountability, ethics enforcement, and anti-corruption provisions. In 2018, the Koch brothers-funded Institute for Free Speech, which aims to deregulate campaign finance contributions, gave the state an A+ for allowing unlimited contributions. In order for any legislation to pass, voters will likely have to amend the state constitution to clarify that its free speech clause does not relate to political contributions. 36 other states have free speech clauses along with campaign contribution limits. State Representative Dan Rayfield talked about the various legislative efforts and ballot measures.
The first one is small donor elections. A big thank you to Commissioner Hardesty, who served on a part of a coalition. Before being elected, served on a coalition to help us develop this policy. And basically, if you agree to cap as a candidate, your contributions to $250. We will match it 6-1. So that way it really empowers regular small donor voters and gives power to them versus your large donors. That's something we want to pass for all legislative races. What's the biggest hurdle? Money, right? And that's where we need your help as we look to prioritize where the money is going to be spent here in Oregon. The second thing we have is we're looking at how do you lessen, the first category is how do you lessen impact of big money in politics, small donor elections. Second thing, constitutional amendment. We have to pass a constitutional amendment as we go forward. And this is with the Oregon Constitution, right? Under Oregon Constitution, we can't even require paid for by. That's the way our Oregon Constitution works right now. Let that sink in, right? Like Washington, they can say their top three donors who funded this ad over $50,000. We can't do any of that here in Oregon. Change the Constitution, we can do that. Change the Constitution, we can put limits in place, which then gets me to the federal Constitution. There's a bill called that is basically being a proponent by Move to Amend or the Wolf Pack, where we look at how do we create a constitutional convention to look at the national constitution where we can reform that, where we can now cap independent expenditures, dark money, and really get at the really large impact that we have absolutely no control over based upon our Supreme Court. That has to change in the long term if we're really going to make a difference. Yeah. Now get into like transparency stuff, what I call exposing dark money. We have nonprofit disclosure. This is something we can do. Screw the Supreme Court, right? There are things that we can actually do. Right now, 501c4s, 501c6s can take unlimited amounts of contributions in right now, unlimited amounts of money, and can spend that money unlimited in our campaigns. We don't know who the heck is donating to these campaigns right now. So what the bill essentially will do, well, if you are going to engage in spending money, we want to know who your donors are if you're a 501c4 or a 5c6. If you're going to spend money in politics, we should know who you are spending that money. So yeah, it's what we do in every other element of our campaign finance laws. We have just not changed that law for our 501c4s and 6s. Then we also know that when you put in a constitutional amendment to then cap contributions, what's going to happen? Our independent expenditures are going to go through the roof. Because if you are Phil Knight and you have $1 million, $6 million, however many millions of dollars you want to spend in elections, you are not going to stop because there's a $500 limiter. You're not going to stop because there's a $1,000 limiter. So what we have to do is increase our transparency on independent expenditures and actually better define what we call coordination. So, for instance, right now, if Jeff was running a campaign and he came to me and I was running a PAC, he could hand me his polling data. I could then run hit ads against his opponent. That would be considered an independent expenditure, and really that's what we would call coordination. It should be under an in-kind expenditure, which would be subject to campaign finance limitations. And so there's little fixes like that that we can actually do. They're really wonky. Also looking about, do you remember Priority Oregon during the summer who was spending millions of dollars of ads against the governor? None of that, we got to see how much money was being spent. Those were independent expenditures. And do you want to know why? Because under Oregon law, they didn't use the key words, vote against Governor Brown, vote for someone else. That defined it as an issue ad because it was done during this period. What we want to do is actually go with the FCC rules that uses a reasonable person standard so we can see how much money is now being spent on our elections, even though under the Supreme Court, we cannot cap that. We have a lot of other bills, including requiring paid for by, putting limits on national popular vote, which is something that Lissick McGuire and many other folks said if you're the highest office in the land, should be voted on by a majority of the folks.
Newly elected State Senator Jeff Golden will head up the new campaign finance committee and spoke about the importance of not accepting PAC money.
I represent District 3 in the State Senate. That's the Rogue Valley, the Medford, Ashland, Applegate area. And I've been in public life down there for a long time, mostly in public broadcasting. And when I decided to run for the seat, you know, primarily at the time for climate action, that's what I've been involved with, the Democratic leadership came down and they were looking for a candidate for the seat. This seat was held for years by Dr. Alan Bates, a wonderful legislator who died suddenly. The leadership of my party said, when I told them that I wouldn't be taking PAC money, and I got to say as an aside, I'm really happy that national candidates are finally saying they won't take PAC money, won't take fossil fuel PAC money. Terrific. We need more than that. And my pledge was to take no PAC money, including from groups that I want to support and ally with in the legislature, like labor and women's rights and the environment. That's a side conversation that I won't get into right now. But the response was, my, aren't you a noble fellow, but you don't have a clue how the system works. And if you want to get there, of course you have to take our PAC money, Democratic PAC money. I was clear and am clear that attitude, I'm going to take good PAC money but not bad PAC money, is not going to capture the potential swell of public opinion that we need to change campaign finance reform in this country. So, I relied on a lot of help from my friends, including, and I got to call out Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer, who had me up here for a fabulous party to raise a lot of money for people who feel the way we do. She is making such a difference in the state in a lot of ways, including the candidates she supports. I won a hotly contested four-way primary handily and then went on to win the general election. And what I think, you know, what the experience, I knew at the time there'd be a political advantage to being able to say, I'm not taking anybody's PAC money, but I really had no idea about the hunger out there for a different way of doing politics. So the party leadership was saying, well, there's all this money you're going to give up. And I don't think they really understand the magnitude of the political advantage of coming out for a new politics. I think they're behind the times. So I knocked on a lot of doors. And like most candidates, I had my 20-second rap for people who were willing to talk to me. And it went something like, hi, I'm Jeff Golden. I'm running for the state senate in this area. And I'm meeting, knocking on as many doors as I can, meeting as many people as I can, partly because I love doing this. This is the fun part. Partly because I'm taking no PAC or lobby money, underline that. So this is the only way I can win. And I'm going to say 4 out of 5 times, now I was not knocking on Republican doors. I was knocking on Democratic and non-affiliated doors. I'm going to say 4 out of 5 times, when I got that much out, people started nodding their heads. And 2 or 3 out of 5 times, people were going, yes, finally, you don't have to tell me anything else. So if progressives are going to make advances in this country, they have to recognize that new reality. So I can't be more excited to be here. I asked the Senate president, when he asked me what I wanted for committee assignments, if he would create a campaign finance committee, just trying to kind of plant the seed. And to my astonishment, he called me 3 days later. He said, I just did it, and you're the chair. So I take the governor's commitment to campaign finance reform, and she's talking about it every chance she can, starting with the constitutional amendment that makes it clear that the legislature and the people can limit campaign contributions. She's serious about this. Also because my vice chair in the committee, we've had one meeting so far, Senator Tim Knope from Central Oregon, at the first meeting said, this our current system, I'm paraphrasing, our current system of financing is a mortal threat to our democracy. Yeah. We've got to do something about it. So we looked at him, really? We do? So the stars are lined up. And we have, this isn't going to be simple. There's a lot of heavy lifting to do. But we have an opportunity that I've never seen in my 40 years of watching Oregon politics before. It has a lot to do with what the people, the point to which the people in this room have brought us, the work of Representative Rayfield over time. And I'm just thrilled to be here.
For KBOO News, this is Oliver Minslow.
Hey everyone, this is Lakeisia Griffin, and I'll be joined with Rachel Hartley to talk about the news that was reported today and give our perspective on what's been going on. One of the major stories today was Joanne Hardesty's non-cooperation with the council. According to a press release that was released from her office, she is directing the Portland Fire and Rescue to indefinitely pause any unreinforced masonry building enforcement. And so the URM ordinance was approved by the City Council a few months ago before Hardesty took office, and would require all unreinforced masonry buildings to display a large placard with a red U for unsafe. Now, Commissioner Hardesty wants to pause that, saying that we need to spend more time really looking at what does that entail and how will that disproportionately impact non-white communities. And so I thought this was really interesting because I think it just reinforces the fact that there are so many ways that communities of color and marginalized communities can be negatively impacted. Joanne had a quote that said, quote, "No one is interested in putting our residents at risk, but we need to look at ways to better support businesses and nonprofits in seismically upgrading their buildings," Hardesty says. "A placard is a Band-Aid for a much larger problem," end quote. And so, again, yeah, I think I really shout out to Joanne for showing that despite not having many votes within the council, she's really finding ways to, you know, shake the table and make changes in ways that she can make changes. And I think, you know, something like this seems like it's to help the community. And I think it just continues to show that we need to really look into some of these ordinances and really look into the language that's used to express something that seems like it's supposed to help, but will disproportionately affect other folks. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Joined by Rachel here.
Hi, welcome to the Community Report. Thank you so much for that. And I totally, this was a story that was in the news for earlier this evening. So I just wanted to know, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'm like, again, I'm just really proud of the work she's doing already.
Same, yeah.
So quickly.
Yeah.
And it reminds us that we all have a way to impact, even if we feel like there are forces and barriers against us to get things done. There are creative and also really impactful ways to like dig deep into these policies, mm-hmm. and find out ways that they continuously perpetuate inequity. And so, yeah, shout out to Joanne and everything that she's doing. Yeah. It's really, again, it's opened my eyes to the kind of like silent ways that communities of color and marginalized communities can be held back.
Exactly. And I think that what's cool about Joanne is that she is praised by a lot of people, but of course, since she's now a politician, she just gets a lot of scrutiny. But what's cool about her is that she is just so willing to just take the scrutiny and just willing to, mm-hmm. listen to the people and just to say, like, yes, this is what's going on. This is what I'm doing wrong into somebody else's eyes. Like, let me see what I can do for them. And so I think that this is just another accomplishment of her, like, flexibility, mm-hmm. and her ability to stay true to the cause and while doing it in a diplomatic way.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, it was mentioned in the story that the NAACP compared this big red U sign as something that was similar to exclusionary laws, redlining, and the use of eminent domain.
Yeah.
And so, again, I would have never, just by the title of the ordinance,
yeah,
I would have never even considered that to be, mm-hmm. something that they would use against, you know, people of color.
Yeah.
Low-key, though, you know, like, low-key.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. And then the next story that was also in the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Was this new net neutrality bill. And it's a bill to, like, preserve a free and open internet that's on its way to the Senate after the FCC got it net neutrality in 2017.
Right, thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel about it? Well, I mean, from the story itself.
Yeah, it's good to know that there will be a chance to kind of offset them taking away net neutrality, because we don't the thing about knowledge is when we have those kinds of restrictions is that we start to only receive knowledge from folks who have the means to provide that information. So if you make it so that there some folks can buy space to make sure that their information is, you know, at the top of the list or at the top of your Google search.
Yeah.
There's fundamental problems with that, and it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I think. And I think they ignored a lot of the studies, a lot of the experts who weighed in on it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I mean, how much are we going to continuously go against the public's fears and the public's worries and treat them like they're nothing?
Mm-hmm.
So to have this bill to try to combat that is, it's going to be great. It's good. It's a good sign.
And it's a good sign because, I mean, net neutrality came into, of course, people were talking about it before the recent election, but it really became conversation after the recent election, and it made people, it was almost like a Y2K sort of like situation where people were like, oh, well, now since the government is going to have like control over what we are searching for, then it's kind of like, well, now we're being surveillanced even more. So I'm really glad, but of course there's going to be people fighting it. So what else? My goal is to, you know, look into the resources, because I get little text messages from them and they're like, oh, are you going to vote for net neutrality or no, or contact your senators and stuff? But there's always more that you can do, not only just to contact your local representatives, but to stay up to date on net neutrality and the process of that.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it was kind of interesting seeing the commentary around it while everyone was kind of like pushing folks to pay attention.
Yeah, not a lot of people knew.
To speak out. And I think it's because we're kind of in an era where, you know, our media is controlled in a lot of ways that people don't realize.
Totally.
And so people kind of get really, kind of lazy in a sense that they don't think about how that will actually impact them.
Mm-hmm.
And because also it's kind of difficult to understand for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people don't realize that even in like television media and movies and, you know, we're getting the content from these large conglomerates.
Right.
And these huge networks who get to determine the content across so many platforms.
Right.
In ways that like also intertwines with the internet and television. It's crazy. It's wild.
It's wild because, and also, majority of people who do discuss the ins and outs of net neutrality are folks who have social media, right? Or folks who are really in tune to social media or like follow the functions of it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And so if you aren't as adamant about being on social media and things like that, you may not know exactly about net neutrality until about now, when folks have been talking about this since before the election. So it's kind of like something that has been growing, but at the end of the day, this story was, at least during the news, was very important to me personally, because it's something that I've been trying to get people to talk about, even in like close friends, family, and I ask them, do you know about net neutrality? Because if you don't, let me tell you. It's a really big deal, and it's going to also, you know, involve television, and that's kind of scary.
You make a good point that, I'm pretty sure the only places that I saw information about net neutrality
was like Twitter.
Was on social media, and like not necessarily... I mean, there were some websites who, you know, they posted information on it, and they had little, like, you know, in red and bold, like, hey, net neutrality, this is what it is. You should pay attention. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see it, like, maybe, like, in other forms of media, like television.
Totally not. Like, CNN was not talking about it.
Or, like, ads or anything. Right. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting. We might have missed a lot of folks because of the lack of outreach in other areas.
True.
And it was in the news, of course, but not everyone reads newspapers anymore. And most people get their news from digital resources. So.
They should. But they should be listening to the Cape of Evening News as well.
Right.
Shameless plug.
Then they would know.
Yeah, then they would know. And here we try to have facts, you know, and we try to make it in a way that people would not only want to listen to it, but still get the proper information.
Right.
Because we personally, like social media, it hurt me to know that that's where I was getting the news about net neutrality was only on Twitter. And I would look up everywhere else and I couldn't find it. But Twitter is it's a black hole of information, and it's not always correct. More than half the time, it's incorrect. So, yeah, shout out to the Cable Evening News.
Yeah, shout out to Cable just in general.
Totally. Yeah, hey, and also to continue the community report, we wanted to end off the rest of our time with Happy Black History Month.
Yes.
and snaps on that. I love your all black.
Thank you.
Looks great.
It's like the uniform, you know?
It's the uniform, yeah. If you're in black or in some sort of like neutral color, whatever, it's dark. I'm like, yeah, do it. It's all black, yeah. And what's cool is that The Root is doing a 28 Days of Literary Blackness.
Mm.
And earlier in the newscast, we had someone had read an article about literary arts and how Catcher in the Rye author is having more of his writings being published.
Right.
I believe it was said that there was going to be a book, things like that. And so in relation to that, because literary arts is the news, you know, depending on like how you look at it, especially with the Catcher in the Rye, a lot of people at least have had relation with that book.
Right.
And I want to relate it to black history because of literary arts.
Right.
This is why we can have black history or keep black history going, not just through like oral tradition or events or things like that. Having something written down so that we can pass it along.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first book for their day, for the first day, is, of course, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, yeah.
I just had to get silent because it's Zora Neale Hurston, and
yeah,
she's one of my inspirations, a lot of people's inspirations.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is phenomenal if you haven't read it.
I actually haven't read it, and I'm going to tell you, just because like I really didn't get a chance to explore black authors until very recently.
Wow.
And just because, you know, education nowadays is very Eurocentric. And I realized, like, to find myself in literature, like, you really have to do some digging.
Yeah.
And so shout out to Literary Arts for putting on something like that and to bring those people to light, because, it's just not something that's readily available all the time in most schools, is to be, you know, approached or to have an approach that incorporates, you know, people of color, authors.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, that's awesome.
Not only is it history, it's news, and it should just be tradition.
Right.
Exactly. Yo, and I have such a close relation with this book because it's the first book I read that's by her. She has other writings that I believe everyone should totally get into.
Yeah.
And she is just so profound in how she speaks and the way she writes. And even by the first sentence that you're reading, you're just sucked into her world. And if you have relation to her world as a black person, if you have relation to like black people, if you have relation to any sort of situation that she's putting you in, even if you don't, you're still sucked in, and you it's like she's creating a seat at the table to have the tough conversations about race in America, especially when it comes to black women.
Right.
So, and speaking of that, up next is Evergreen with Bread and Roses.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking about not only our favorite black women in black history, but who's currently making black history. Who do you think will make Black history and things like that. Right. Right? And so Zora is just a name that a lot of people that I will be bringing up in the next program, mm-hmm. that she has more than likely inspired. So right. yeah, shout out to that. And I'm excited for the next day, or at least the next Friday, because we'll talk about the next book that they'll bring up mm-hmm. For Friday. And yeah, so that's so exciting. And I'm also excited for next Friday as well, for our programming that we'll be having surrounding around Black History Month. In honor of the Black Panthers. So tune yeah. in next Friday for intergenerational dialogue conversations, where we will be talking about the Black Panthers and the Panther chapter in Portland and the impact that that history has made for young Black people in the city today.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, totally.
Sounds amazing.
Awesome. Cool. Any other tidbits of news that you wanted to tell the listeners or anything?
No, I think you guys covered a lot.
We covered a lot today, so, yeah. Shout out to the news team for today. They did amazing.
The listeners have a lot to go off of and, you know, do some more research on. So, yeah, no, I won't overload their brains in this world of so much news.
Well, I'm going to remind everyone to read up and to research and to always stay in tune with the news. Up next is Evergreen with yours truly, Rachel Hartley.
Sorry, we had to leave you hanging there for a second. It's okay. KBOO's back. KBOO's always here for you. That reminds me. Hey, are you a member of KBOO? When that moment happened, where you said, oh my gosh, this moment's about me. Because maybe it was. Guess what you can do? If you're not a member, I suggest you go onto our website at kboo.fm and become a member of KBOO today. And see, you can sound like those people in the background having so much fun. Coming up next, you're going to hear more Rachel, and she's going to be, well, she's going to be entertaining. She's going to give you something to think about. In the meantime, oh yeah, KBOO Portland. Here you go.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Voice, an evening on Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church in Portland. The One Voice event features a film screening of Unaccompanied, Alone in America, a documentary about immigrant children who have been separated from their parents while seeking refuge in the U.S., as well as performances by Jennifer Berezin and Chris Webster. This is a benefit for Immigration Counseling Service, Oregon's oldest nonprofit immigration law firm. Again, that's One Voice, Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church, 4525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. Tish Hinojosa is the featured performer at the February 15th concert. Singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa's songs are a blend of Americana, country, Latino, and pop. She has been a featured artist at the White House, Austin City Limits, and a Prairie Home Companion. Again, Tish Hinojosa appearing on the PFS stage on Friday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends.